Okay, so this is the chapter on the cosmic illusion, and we are on page 436 in the electronic version, a paragraph beginning, dream is felt to be unreal. In this section of the paragraph, of the chapter, Sri Aurobindo is dealing with the idea of the cosmic illusion. And he has introduced the notion by first talking about the various ways by which we intuit this meaninglessness of the world, that there's no meaning. And this is a kind of a contrary intuition, one may say, that coexists with its opposite, that the world is meaningful. And he talks about two sources to this kind of sense, one of them being vital and arising out of our experiences of life, our frustrations and dissatisfactions, which are mostly at the personal level, and the other being mental, and the vital always calls the mind to its aid in justifying itself. And due to the mind's ability to encompass large tracts of space and time, it gives a more philosophical explanation or justification to the wishes or feelings of the vital. In the case of the mind, therefore, there is the sense that nothing has really changed, that humanity has tried through the centuries and millennia to arrive at some kind of solution to the problems of suffering and of evil and ignorance. And in all these cases, there have been various types of solutions offered, and it has maybe ameliorated certain conditions a little bit, but there has been no enduring solution. And so out of this comes the notion that there is no meaning to this universe, and hence it is an illusion. Now, taking this further, Sri Aurobindo is going to look at the three kinds of explanations that one can give for it, which the mind tries to provide, because if it justifies this kind of sense, it also tries to give a explanation for it. And one of these explanations is the materialist's explanation, which is that everything is arising out of a kind of inconscient energy, as he says, an inconscient energy, which throws up consciousness, as the scientists say, as an epiphenomenon. The second one would be that there is some kind of reason why things are the way they are over here, but that reason doesn't have any basis in our universe or cosmos, that this reason is inherent to some transaction between the cosmos and some transcendental reality, which is hidden from us, and which can either be seen as a kind of a cosmic kind of cruelty, or it may be seen as a source of some kind of meaning which is not easily apparent. And the meaning that he provides, one of the meanings at least that he provides for this second option, is that this creation has been put forward as a kind of meaningless jumble, the one may say antithesis of a divine order or a divine creation, with the purpose of allowing the experience or the possibility of the experience to souls that wish to experience this possibility, so that they may go through the experience and then realize that it's not desirable and come out of it. But Sri Aurobindo is not happy with this answer. And the reason he gives for dismissing it is that there is too much coherence, or there is too much reason to the universe, to the cosmos, to dismiss it on these grounds. We cannot say that it is meaningless. This is a very interesting reason, and I think it merits probing a little more. It arises from the search for meaning, and this is something which this book is shot through with, and Sri Aurobindo's entire opus is shot through with. From a certain point of view, this search for meaning is quite a significant thing, which arises more from Western sources of philosophy than from India. And I say this because search for meaning for Sri Aurobindo implies that there is some kind of explanation for everything, that there is an what one might call an integral explanation. Now, is there such an integral explanation? Some schools, many of the schools in India, which are illusionistic, deny it. They say that to this question of why whatever exists, exists, there is no real answer. Hence, the question is what one might call a philosophically illegitimate question for these schools. But however, for Sri Aurobindo, it's a legitimate question. And here is where there is a certain kind of, the beginnings of an appeal to the intuition of meaning. That somewhere in us, we feel that there is a meaning to the cosmos, that there is a meaning to the human place in the cosmos. And in fact, this is the basis of the Greek idea of philosophia. Philosophia is love of Sophia, which is Sophos, or wisdom. And wisdom is, in that sense, a kind of intrinsic sense of the connectedness of all things, and a kind of a reason that rests on the notion of gnosis. Gnosis, from which the same Indo-European root for jnana, knowledge, is arising out of that. And so too the power of gnosis, which is called logos, or the connected reason of things. So we find that there is an appeal to this kind of an intuition in Sri Aurobindo, and he is not happy as a result to take answers such as there is a certain kind of a whim to the cosmos, a cruelty to the cosmos, or a kind of a training ground for souls that may come and then experience its bitterness and then decide that this is not the place to be at, and therefore get out of it. He, on the other hand, proposes that to this second kind of idea, the idea of a world in which there is a kind of invisible transaction between the transcendental and the cosmic, if there is to be a totality, a meaning, that meaning can only be found in a cosmic sense of something that is transient and leads towards a fullness. In other words, if souls are entering this imperfection, it is not so as to become disillusioned and get out of it, but so as to become agents that participate in its perfection. And the very sense of this cosmos would then be a evolution towards such a perfection. So this is how he argues out of that particular trajectory. Then he takes up the third justification or reasoning for positing this kind of a illusionistic universe, and that is that it is fundamentally our experience is fundamentally an illusion, and this fundamental illusion arises from the fact that if there is an absolute, and the absolute is real, the absolute is infinite, any kind of ordering of a kind of a cosmos within that reality has to be a falsification of its absoluteness. In other words, any cosmos is a relative cosmos, a cosmos of relations, and a cosmos that exists in relation to the absolute. And hence, it is, in that sense, unreal. Now, he says that certainly there is more justification to this kind of point of view than to the point of view that there is either a cruel God or a God that has created some sort of unhappy world just for the experience of souls to get out of it. But he questions whether just because there is an absolute and a world of relations, we can conclude that this world of relations is unreal. So what is illusionistic about this world of what is called Maya? What is the falsity of it? This is the question. And from there, Sri Aurobindo comes to the reasoning that is adduced for this kind of illusionism. And the reasoning proceeds along these two lines that he's now raising where we are. One is that this is a dream of some kind. And the other is that it is a hallucination of some kind. So, what is meant by dream? And Sri Aurobindo points out that this may be a kind of figure, that it is a dream is not really the argument per se, but a certain kind of metaphor that is used to make the argument. So even if that is the case, what is the justification of such a metaphor? This is the question that he is asking over here. And this was, once again, I've lost the page. It was 436. So over here, so he is beginning to probe the nature of dream. What is a dream? And why is it that we feel that it is at all a valid way of describing illusion to say that our life is like a dream? So that is where we stand right now with this paragraph, dream is felt to be unreal, where he is going to look at the nature of dream. So unless we have some comments, questions, we can proceed from this point.
Debashish, I have a question.
Yes.
When you were saying that Sri Aurobindo differs from the illusionist schools and, let's say, leans towards or is more connected to the Western philosophical view in how he's making his reasons, is that strictly true that it's the Western philosophical influence or influence of the West, or is there, would there be an influence of the East on Sri Aurobindo along these lines of evolution?
I think that's a good question. I think it's difficult to know for sure, but I'd say, speculatively speaking, because Sri Aurobindo's early education was in the West, was in England, and he had much more exposure to Greek philosophy than to Indian philosophy growing up. And he had a pretty good idea of what Plato was saying, what Aristotle was saying, and going back to the pre-Socratics, to people like Heraclitus and Parmenides and people like that, and Pythagoras, this notion of gnosis, this idea of a reason or a logic, but not a logic which is epistemological in the Aristotelian sense, which becomes a kind of attempt to use the mind to arrive at a coherent understanding of the cosmos. But the root of that, the Gnostic root of that, now I'm not using the term Gnostic in the Christian sense or the sort of, alternative Christian sense of Gnostic, but I'm using it in the Greek sense of Gnostic. I think that kind of idea was very strongly with him even when he came into his Indian studies. But when he did come into his Indian studies, when he was in, when he came back to India, I think this is what he intuited in the Upanishads. But when you look at the interpretations of the Upanishads, you find that this idea is not really presented. The idea of knowledge as a coherent, something which has the root of reason, something which is wisdom, is not presented in the Indian interpretations of the Upanishads. So we find that there is a certain kind of movement towards the absolute, or a movement towards some archetypal heaven, but not towards an explanation for the reason of the cosmos. Why is it here? Is it real? If it's real, what is its reality? What is the kind of value that goes into it? What is the meaning of this cosmos? That question is not addressed. But I think he was looking at the Upanishads and seeing that that is really what is at the base of it, of the Upanishads, the question of knowledge, which in many ways we lose sight of in what is called Indian philosophy.
Debashish, would you say then that this might not be the correct word, but that there, in some ways, he had a lens looking through a Greek lens of knowledge, bringing that to the Vedic understanding, or somehow brought that integration from the Greeks too?
I think if you talk about a lens, perhaps there was a predilection which arose due to his early education in that direction. But also, as I was trying to say, in Sri Aurobindo's philosophy, there is always an appeal to an internal intuition that somewhere we can't rest content with certain types of answers, because it knocks on some inner door, as it were. And this is the kind of argument that he uses in The Life Divine too often. It's an implicit argument. It's not necessarily explicit. But, for example, when he says, I read this part. Let's look at this part. It's good to look at. So these three kinds of explanations that he's talking about occur on page 433 and move into page 434, where he says, there's a longish sentence here, but I read it. If it is true that the fundamental laws and values of terrestrial existence are fixed, or that it must always turn in repeated cycles, and this has been for long a very prevalent notion, then this view of things in the end is hardly escapable. For imperfection, ignorance, frustration, and suffering are a dominant factor of the existing world order. The elements contrary to them, knowledge, happiness, success, perfection, are constantly found to be deceptive or inconclusive. The two opposites are so inextricably mixed that if this state of things is not a motion towards a greater fulfillment, if this is the permanent character of the world order, then it is hard to avoid the conclusion that all here is either the creation of an inconscient energy, which would account for the incapacity of an apparent consciousness to arrive at anything, or intentionally a world of ordeal and failure, the issue being not here but elsewhere, or even a vast and aimless cosmic illusion. So these are the three he posits, and then he jumps to the second, kind of leaving the two ends out. Among these alternative conclusions, the second, as it is usually put before us, offers no ground for the philosophic reason, since we have no satisfying indication of the connection between the here and the elsewhere, which are posited against each other but not explained in the inevitability of their relations. And there is no light cast on the necessity or fundamental significance of the ordeal and failure. Already we see in that sentence that his dissatisfaction is coming out of the fact that somewhere an intuition is being violated. The intuition of the search for meaning, of philosophic reason, of the indication of the connection between the here and elsewhere, the inevitability of their relations, etc. You see? And then he posits a kind of like, he brings this reason out of some obscure schools that try to say that, oh, we are here because we are in this experience, so that we may know how bad it is and then never come back from it, which is one of the illusionistic explanations. You see, why are we here if we are permanent souls? We are here because we somehow, due to the freedom of every soul, because every soul is radically free, and in the radical infinity of being, every choice can be made. We have made a choice to explore this possibility of chaos, disorder, unhappiness, ignorance, and falsehood. And so we've plunged into that particular condition because it exists, just so that we may learn that this was a wrong choice and we may get out of it. So he takes that argument, and then this is what he has to say about it. But such a creative motive, necessarily incidental and quite temporary in its incidence, with the earth as its casual field of experience, could hardly by itself account for the immense and enduring phenomenon of this complex universe. You see, what is his appeal? His appeal is again to the order of this universe. It's a complex universe, and it's an immense and enduring phenomenon. We find that there is a certain kind of very vast connectedness which stretches across time and space. And we don't have any explanation for that. We are just saying that it's there for souls to have some kind of experience. So it's not satisfying exactly for that reason, that it violates the intuition of the central gnosis that gives meaning to everything all at once, the one knowing which all else may be known. See, so that's something that I think he found in the Upanishads, but I do feel that, you know, he comes to the Upanishads with a grounding already in a tradition that values this kind of, you know, the love for knowledge, you know, for that kind of intuitive knowledge.
Thank you, Devasheet. That made it very clear.
You see, if you look at the subtext of Sri Aurobindo's arguments, there are a number of reasonings that he is contesting, one may say. And that one sentence where we looked at, before he posits those three reasons, is at the very fundamental base of Indian philosophy. And that is this sentence over here. For imperfection, ignorance, frustration, and suffering are a dominant factor of the existing world order. The elements contrary to them, knowledge, happiness, success, perfection, are constantly found to be deceptive or inconclusive. The two opposites are so inextricably mixed that if the state of things is not a motion towards a greater fulfillment, if this is the permanent character of the world order, then it is hard to avoid the conclusion that all here is either and those three options. So this setup, the way he sets this argument up with regard to these two kinds of possibilities, one possibility being that the cosmos is a movement towards a greater fulfillment, and the other is that this unhappy state is the permanent character of the world order. These two views that he sets up is exactly his subtext for arguing against the permanence of the avidya. And this is the entire history of the Indian tradition. It posits a difference between a state of knowledge, of identity, of the Brahman, of divinity, which it calls vidya, and it posits the experience that we have of separative existence, and it calls it avidya. And then it says, this condition of avidya is a permanent condition. Souls may enter it and get out of it. Souls are not permanently trapped in it, but the condition, in other words, the world, is a world that has been created like this for eternity. It's stasis. It's a state of being that has no change to it. And he's contesting that. And there is no other person who has really contested that in the Indian tradition. Now, has anybody contested that in the Western tradition? I don't think there is a evolutionary view per se in the early Greeks either. But what there is the search for meaning. And what he's saying is, if you really take the search for meaning far enough, you will come to this answer. And people are not doing that. And that's the reason why they can make such, give such solutions as it's meaningless, or its meaning is only that we are here to feel how bad it is and get out of it.
So, Debashisda.
Yeah.
In those search for meanings, what meaning do they attach if evolution is not part of that explanation? So, both in the Western and in the Indian traditions, wherever they've looked for meaning, and they've not gotten as far as that evolution explains a lot of this meaning, where do they end up? I mean, how far do they go, and like, what is that model?
Yeah. So, if we look at, say, the Western tradition, okay, the Western tradition. You have three major historical movements there. First, we find the ancient Greeks. Okay, and the ancient Greeks are actually talking about a mystery. So there is the notion of a mystery, and that there is a certain kind of wisdom or sense of knowledge that what they call the gnosis that is manifesting in the world, and whatever we see which is logical in the world is coming out of that. Okay, that gets a little more objectified during the time of Plato and Aristotle, and particularly with Aristotle, it becomes a certain kind of a search for the rationality of the cosmos, that ideas are perfect, and in the ideal world we can come up with a scheme that gives us total coherence, and that the material world maps to that total coherence. If there's something in the material world, it must be in the ideal world, or in the world of thought. If there's something in the world of thought, it must be present in some form in the world of matter. This is the kind of philosophy that's the meaning, so to say, right? Then there is the intervention of Christianity, which again obscures this entire search for meaning and says that All meaning resides in the transcendent, and the transcendent gives that meaning or grants that meaning only to its elect, which are the fathers of the church, who are, you know, in a position to explain the Bible to people. And then the next movement comes from the Renaissance, which actually throws that idea of knowledge out and returns in a way to the more, it's like a neo-Aristotelianism. And that's why it's called the Renaissance. It's a rebirth. And basically, again, it's a logocentrism. In other words, that there is a order. There is a perfect logic to everything. And we can use our minds to arrive at that. Okay, so these are forms of meaning. If you look at the Indian systems, you find that whatever is in the Veda and the Upanishads is paradoxical, and it may be mapped to the pre-Socratics. There is a wisdom, and that wisdom is expressing in this cosmos. It's a transcendental wisdom that is expressing in the cosmos. But after that, what happens is that they say that this absolute consciousness is totally different from the relative consciousness, and we should not look for a meaning that connects the two. We can only look for a projective mechanism, which is Maya. And how is Maya doing this? Well, say somebody like Shankara will say Maya is inscrutable, and don't ask questions about, you know, what is the reason. There is that reason doesn't exist. It's not legitimate to Maya. Or it will say what he's saying, that you know, we are here as souls that will enter into this field of Maya and we'll get out of it. That's the reason. So he's providing that. He's saying that the two reasons that we are given in the Indian tradition is, number one, don't ask for any reasons. It's reasonless. And number two, the only reason is that we are here to enter into it and get out of it. See, that's the reason. And he's saying they're both unsatisfying. They're satisfying.
Yeah, when we put it in that sweep like that, it certainly seems unsatisfying. But on the other hand, it's hard to believe that Aristotle and Shankara, etc., were like, you know, kind of satisfied with what seems to us sitting here so obviously unsatisfactory once Sri Aurobindo lays out the land like that.
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, when you say it's hard to believe, that is an interesting point. I mean, it's hard to believe because we think that people all thought like us. They didn't. This is the whole thing about discourse. The questions that one asks, that the questions that are not asked, change from time to time. And whatever holds an age together, this is the idea of Yuga Dharma, obscures certain questions. You don't ask those questions. It's exactly what he's saying over here about the fact that there is persistence and logic to the world. That idea that there is persistence and logic to the world is itself a scientific idea. And somebody like Shankara would not even be interested in it because he was not looking at, are there laws to things that persist over time? Where is the need to look for that?
Thank you.
So, you know, this whatever questions we ask are not the same questions that were asked at an earlier time. It doesn't mean that they were asking less sophisticated questions. Just means that they did not address certain areas of knowledge at all.
And even more so if the emphasis on experience than only yoga, right? The emphasis on darshan as well.
Right, exactly. So you see, there is a privileging of the subjective world over the objective world. We don't sufficiently give value already to start with to the objective world. So we can't see that there is many questions there that we are not answering.
Sure. Yeah.
So then is Sri Aurobindo taking from Darwin and the evolutionary ferment that was going on in Europe.
Yes,
at
that time. That's another whole area, because many people have called Sri Aurobindo a post-Darwinian thinker. Post-Darwinian in the sense that this whole notion of evolution becomes a kind of major point of thinking following Darwin. And, you know, there are many thinkers that may be called post-Darwinian thinkers. You know, certainly, you know, in the mental atmosphere of Sri Aurobindo, Darwinian thought would have existed and would have meant something, you know, that it certainly would have had a impact, and that could have translated itself in terms of a search for understanding which relates to evolution. Idea of evolution is not absent in the Indian philosophy, but it's kind of either suppressed, it's symbolic and suppressed, or it belongs to a certain kind of a cosmology which ends at a certain point. Like Sankhya has the notion of evolution. According to Sankhya, Sankhya is not a monism, it's a dualism. So it's not like Vedanta. It's saying that there is a conscious element called soul, and there is an unconscious element which is matter. Now, with soul enters into matter, matter begins reflecting soul, and therefore matter starts evolving. Its evolutes come closer and closer to consciousness of soul. It tries to develop adequacy to the consciousness of the soul while retaining its unconsciousness. In other words, so there we come to living matter or thinking matter, right? Like, you know, say a human being has a large part, which is still the reason they justify their dualism, is that ultimately it's a kind of a uncomfortable, you know, kind of connection, because it's a more adequate evolution of matter, but it still is going to fall back into its inconscience and we'll die, and the soul will remain what it is, conscious. So this is the pre-modern idea of evolution that is present in some schools. But to give a kind of a cosmology which includes the individual and the world and explains its philosophical justification through evolution is not there. And it may very well be that at least in our times, as part of the discourse of our times, the kind of questions that are raised, Darwin plays an important part in opening the door to that kind of thinking, at least. We'll see, in fact, in this particular chapter itself, that Freud plays an important part, and he's going to invoke Freud in this chapter by saying that, you know, we can dismiss with the idea of life being like a dream, because there are other ways of looking at dreams that give it significance. A dream is not a meaningless thing. It has significance.
The next paragraph. Janet Owens, would you like to read next?
Sure. Okay. We're starting with dream is felt to be unreal. Is that the paragraph?
Yes.
Okay. Dream is felt to be unreal first because it ceases and has no farther validity when we pass from one status of consciousness to another, which is our normal status. But this is not by itself a sufficient reason, for it may well be that there are different states of consciousness, each with its own realities. If the consciousness of one state of things fades back and its contents are lost, or, even when caught in memory, seem to be illusory as soon as we pass into another state, that would be perfectly normal. But it would not prove the reality of the state in which we are now. In which we now are, and the unreality of the other which we have left behind us. If earth circumstances begin to seem unreal to a soul passing into a different world or another plane of consciousness, that would not prove their unreality. Similarly, the fact that world existence seems unreal to us when we pass into the spiritual silence or into some nirvana does not of itself prove that the cosmos was all the time an illusion. The world is real to the consciousness dwelling in it, and unconditioned existence is real to the consciousness absorbed in nirvana. That is all that is established. But the second reason for refusing credit to our sleep experience is that a dream is something evanescent, without antecedents, and without a sequel. Ordinarily, too, it is without any sufficient coherence or any significance intelligible to our waking beings. If our dreams were like our waking life, an aspect of coherence, each night taking up and carrying further a past continuous and connected sleep experience, as each day takes up again our waking world experience, then dreams would assume to our mind quite another character. There is therefore no analogy between a dream and waking life. These are experiences quite different in their character, validity, order. Our life is accused of evanescence and often is accused too, as a whole, of a lack of inner coherence and significance. But its lack of complete significance may be due to our lack or limitation of understanding. Actually, when we go within and begin to see it from within, it assumes a complete connected significance. At the same time, whatever lack of inner coherence was felt before disappears, and we see that it was due to the incoherence of our own inner seeing and knowledge and was not at all a character of life. There is no surface incoherence in life. It rather appears to our minds as a chain of firm sequences, and if that is a mental delusion, as it is sometimes alleged, if the sequence is created by our minds and does not actually exist in life, that does not remove the difference of the two states of consciousness. For in dream, the coherence given by an observing inner consciousness is absent. And whatever sense of sequence there is seems to be due to a vague and false imitation of the connections of waking life. A subconscious mimesis. But this imitative sequence is shadowy and imperfect, fails and breaks always, and is often wholly absent. We see, too, that the dream consciousness seems to be wholly devoid of that control which the waking consciousness exercises to a certain extent over life circumstances. It has the nature automatism of a subconscient construction and nothing of the conscious will and organizing force of the evolved mind of a human being. Again, the evanescence of a dream is radical, and one dream has no connection with another. But the evanescence of the waking life is of details. There is no evidence of evanescence in the connected totality of world experience. Our bodies perish, but souls proceed from birth to birth through the ages. Stars and planets may disappear after a lapse of aeons or of many light cycles. But universe, cosmic existence, may well be a permanent, as it is certainly a continuous activity. There is nothing to prove that the infinite energy which creates it has an end or a beginning, either of itself or of its action. So far, there is too great a disparateness between dream life and waking life to make the analogy applicable. But it may be questioned whether our dreams are indeed totally unreal and without significance.
We can stop there, Janet. I think we can stop and consider this paragraph and then move on. This is a longish paragraph. I think what he's trying to do is he's taking the argument that life is like a dream and he's probing it. So in what way can we make the analogy between life and dream? This is the question that he's taking up. And the first kind of idea that he's looking at is that there is a certain sense of unreality to dreams. So just off the bat, and a kind of a generic or a general sense of unreality, that we have a kind of much more real experience of our everyday material existence. And when we go to sleep and we dream, there seems to be a certain kind of unreality. When we come back to the world, we feel the dream was unreal. But he says that all that means is that these are two different states of experience. And he takes the issue, for example, of the experience of nirvana or some such experience in which the material existence is felt to be completely unreal. He's saying that all that means is that the human consciousness, when it travels from state of existence to state of existence, has a certain sense of immediacy and a sense of the reality of that state of existence. And other states of existence are felt by it to be unreal. It does not make them unreal. It just makes them other states of existence. So that is the first argument that he's taking up. The second argument has to do with the evanescence, as he's saying. And evanescence is the notion that there is, again, what he posited earlier, that the cosmos, or at least the material cosmos, in which our waking lives are lived, has a coherence to it, coherence in time and space. So that there is a certain map that is going to be enduring, and we can look at that map not only in our lifetimes but through the centuries and point to the same, you know, places and things, that there is a certain kind of endurance and a certain kind of a logic to the connectedness of all these things. And then in terms of time, too, there is a certain kind of cause and effect relation. And it brings up the idea that illusionistic schools may question that cause and effect relation and say that that is an illusion, mental illusion. But he's saying that even if it's a mental illusion, the mind can't manufacture that kind, the same kind of illusion in dream. If it can manufacture it in waking, it is a certain operation. And whether we see it as a property of life and of matter or a property of mind, the state of existence of material life has a coherence to it, and the state of existence of the dream life has an evanescence to it. An evanescence because the same objects do not endure, nor is there the sense of a kind of a person tied by a history of enduring movements or enduring objects through which it moves. See? So the observer and the sense of the personal biography that we kind of to some extent invent for ourselves due to our memory, which has its anchor in enduring material objects and experiences through those objects, is not the same in the world of dream. So what he's again pointing out is that what we are seeing is that the analogy between dream and waking is a tenuous one, because neither are they comparable as states of existence, and neither of them is more unreal than the other. You cannot say a dream is unreal from that point of view, because when you're living in a dream, the dream is pretty real. When you're living in reality, material reality is real, and dream seems unreal. And on the other hand, you cannot compare the two in terms of coherence, because they have different kinds of experienced realities in terms of coherence and evanescence. So this is essentially what he's pointing out, and from that he's saying that on those grounds, the analogy is not that good. It's also interesting that when he's talking about the coherence of the material existence, one of the arguments that he's using is that things remain over here, that there is an endurance to things. And in that he's utilizing both objective and subjective factors. So objective factors, of course, you know, that what he's saying, stars and planets may disappear after a lapse of eons or of many light cycles, but universe, cosmic existence may well be a permanent and certainly a continuous activity. But on the other hand, he's also positing the permanence of the subjective world, and by saying our bodies perish, but souls proceed from birth to birth through the ages. So we find that Sri Aurobindo adduces arguments sometimes which are not obvious to our experience. And this is one of those cases. And when he does so, it is clearly out of his own experience that he's adducing these arguments. It's as if he's thinking to himself and he's communicating with the world, but he's drawing on his own experience as a form of universal experience. It's so as to say that you too can experience this, but if you don't experience it, take it from as a fact that it exists because somebody has experienced it. Now this form of argument is part of the Indian system of argument, because from the Indian system of argument we have a different validation system. The validation system comes from experiences of people. So it says that if somebody experiences something, to what extent is it valid? And it can look at its own experience and it can compare it to the experiences of others. And just like in Western science, we build an archive of results and experiments. So we say that you can repeat this experiment yourself and you will see the same result. Number of people have done it already and they came to the same result. This is another way of saying the same thing, saying that there is an archive of experiences, subjective experiences, on which I'm drawing and which I can validate in my own life. Psychologically speaking, it's a different methodology, but a methodology which is, you know, increasingly used in transpersonal psychology.
So, the questions that are talking of the incoherence of dream life, right? Is that incoherence the only reason we prioritize our waking life over the dream life?
Yeah, he's saying that both those reasons are reasons we prioritize. One is incoherence and the other is endurance. You know, because we come back to, you see, the fact is that before I went to sleep, I saw a certain world. After I came back from my sleep, I saw the same world. See? So there is a certain endurance, and that's why I start thinking that whatever I experienced in between must be unreal. And then whatever I experience when I come go back to dream again the next night, I don't experience the same world that I experienced the last night. So there is that's the fact of evanescence. So the persistence of you know, the material world and the evanescence of dream, plus the fact that we keep returning to this world and experiencing life here, makes us feel that this is more real than that. But when we experience dream, we feel that that is real. However, we don't compare that to the material life because we don't come back to that same dream. We don't know that we will wake up and live in a material world.
There's a certain nice balance to that. I think, you know, the thought of if every night when I went to sleep, my dream would pick up from where it left off the night before, that doesn't appeal to me at all. One of the things that I really like about dreaming is that I never know what is going to happen and it's always something different. But I think if waking life was the same way where it was always different, there would be a chaos to that that would be very hard to live with. So I think there's a really nice balance that during waking life it's constant and in our dream life it's not, and that anything is possible. And I it's like almost by design, because it, maybe we need both types of experiences.
Sure. Yeah, sure. I mean, they are different states of existence, as he's saying, and they have different laws and laws of experience. And those laws of experience are certainly, as you're saying, there is a certain kind of, you know, even an, we may intuit a certain deeper reason or meaning to that as well. It's as if you know, like as he will point out in terms of the planes of consciousness, as if the material world was meant to solidify certain realities, and those other worlds that we enter in dream or in trance are those in which we move more freely over possibilities. And there is a need for both, the two exchange freely between these two states of existence through our travels in them.
But is that also because of the incompleteness of our evolution? Like, for example, does Sri Aurobindo, would somebody like Sri Aurobindo and the mother also dream that way? If at all something, a word like that is applicable to them?
Yeah, I mean, dream.
Wow, that's a great question.
Yeah, I think dream, you know, he will get into that. He will talk about various kinds of dream. This chapter is very interesting because he kind of provides almost like a cartography of the subjective world. But at the same time, the nature of dream to have a different kind of coherence that is not the same as the coherence of the material world, a certain freedom. And he will ultimately kind of look at material life also as a kind of dream. I mean, he will see, he will try to show that there is an analogy possible, but it's not an analogy of unreality. It's an analogy of reality. Because he's saying that they are operating in a different way, but they are both symbolical realms, realms of symbolical, you know, manipulation or symbolical, you know, interactions, relations.
Yeah, thank you. Daniel Harris, would you like to read next? John Robert, would you like to read next? Looks like not available.
Sure. But it may be questioned whether our dreams are indeed totally unreal and without significance, whether they are not a figure, an image record, or a symbolic transcription or representation of things that are real. For that we have to examine, however summarily, the nature of sleep and of dream phenomena, their process of origination and their provenance. What happens in sleep is that our consciousness withdraws from the field of its waking experiences. It is supposed to be resting, suspended, or in abeyance, but that is the superficial view of the matter. What is in abeyance is the waking activities. What is at rest is the surface mind and the normal conscious action of the bodily part of us. But the inner consciousness is not suspended. It enters into new inner activities, only a part of which, a part happening or recorded in something of us that is near to the surface, we remember. There is maintained in sleep, thus near the surface, an obscure subconscious element, which is a receptacle or passage for our dream experiences and itself also a dream builder. But behind it is the depth and mass of the subliminal, the totality of our concealed inner being and consciousness, which is of quite another order. Normally, it is a subconscient part in us, intermediate between consciousness and pure inconscience, that sends up through this surface layer its formations in the shape of dreams. Constructions marked by an apparent inconsequence and incoherence. Many of these are fugitive structures built upon circumstances of our present life, selected apparently at random and surrounded with a fantasy of variation. Others call back the past, or rather selected circumstances and persons of the past, as a starting point for similar fleeting edifices. There are other dreams of the subconscious which seem to be pure fantasy without any such initiation or basis. But the new method of psychoanalysis, trying to look for the first time into our dreams with some kind of scientific understanding, has established in them a system of meanings, a key to things in us which need to be known and handled by the waking consciousness. This of itself changes the whole character and value of our dream experience. It begins to look as if there were something real behind it, and as if, too, that something were an element of no mean practical importance.
So here again we find a return of that search for meaning. See, that he probes the dream reality, and again, just as in the entire scientific field of psychology, to probe the hidden life, the hidden subjective life, to find meaning in it. What does, how does it relate to our everyday waking existence, and what is the logic of this hidden life? Is there a logic to it? This becomes the question, and this question is pursued by the search for meaning. And this is exactly how Sri Aurobindo is going to move into the world of dream to probe it. And so that's how he begins this paragraph, by questioning whether our dreams are indeed totally unreal and without significance, or whether they are not a figure, an image record, or a symbolic transcript or representation of things that are real. And so we find that there again he is positing a number of possibilities, particularly these two major possibilities. One is that it's a figure or an image record. Okay. In other words, there is a certain system of signs that is being deployed, that whatever we experience in our dreams is a kind of mnemonic, a language of signs that doesn't have necessarily a universal language like we have in our waking life, that connects all of us, the currency of language. But on the other hand, that is not meaningless, that has its own intrinsic logic. So that is the image record. And then he takes that one step further and says, or a symbolic transcript or representation of things that are real. So looking at it from two directions. One is, if we look at it from the waking life, we find that there is a image record. So there are these images that are giving a certain kind of a significant logic to some experience, which we are calling our dream experience. Or there is an even deeper experience, an experience that is of spiritual realities, that is expressing through symbols. And this word of symbols is being received by us as a symbolic transcript, reading a text, like reading a text of symbols, like a poem, a symbolic poem is being played out in front of us. And we find actually that very pregnant line, he's in a sense moving between the kind of deep dream interpretations we find with Freud to the deep interpretations of Jung. See, the Freudian dream interpretation is that of a world of signs, where the signs are coming to us from our everyday life into the subconscious. And then the rest of that particular paragraph is really about the life of the dream of the subconscious, which is as he says, an intermediate layer between the inconscient and the waking consciousness. And in this intermediate layer, the images of our waking life are being utilized to express certain types of unrealized desires or various kinds of repressions, suppressions, and other types of relations with the world, using the images of that life as a transcript, an image transcript. And then in the next paragraph, he'll go further deeper and show how even deeper realities are thrown on the surface through the subliminal consciousness. And in this paragraph, he's already positing these two realms, that we first enter into a layer of consciousness in sleep, which is the subconscious layer, But then there are deeper layers that connect us to the universal subjective that somebody like Jung would have called the collective unconscious. But there are various layers to that. And we move from the personal to the universal and to this realm of meaning where there are symbolic correspondences between things and a kind of dream logic of symbols that manifests these realities to us in our dream. So towards the end of that, so he brings up these two, the realm of the subconscious. There is maintained in sleep, thus near the surface, an obscure subconscious element, which is a receptacle of passage for our dream experiences, and itself also a dream builder. So the passage of dream experiences is coming from deeper in the subliminal. And it is building dreams as well, because it's taking images of our waking life and connecting them either to a more repressed layer of the subconscious or to even deeper universal planes that one might call planes of universal collective consciousness. So this, normally it is a subconscious part, but he says, but behind it is the depth and mass of the subliminal, the totality of our concealed inner being and consciousness, which is of quite another order. And if we mostly dream subconscious dreams, it is only because it is the closest to our waking surface, and we drop into another world, as the mother said, we haven't built bridges between these worlds, so we forget those kinds of dreams. Only in some cases they are retained, but in most cases we lose the connection, but we are definitely moving from realm to realm of dream itself. Just as there is a waking world and a dreaming world, there are many dreaming worlds, and that's the point he's making over here. And then he ends by invoking Freud and psychoanalysis and saying that even your subconscious dreams have a meaning. Ultimately, there is a reality to it because there is a meaning to it. The new method of psychoanalysis, trying to look for the first time into our dreams with some kind of scientific understanding, has established in them a system of meanings, a key to things in us which need to be known and handled by the waking consciousness. This of itself changes the whole character and value of our dream experience. It begins to look as if there was something real behind it, and as if too that something were an element of no mean practical importance. So he's sort of turning the tables on the illusionistic idea. He's saying that life is not an illusion because it is like dream, which is illusory, but dream is a reality because it has meaning just like life. It has another kind of coherence, but it has a coherence of its own.
So when they say life is illusory, so there is an inherent metaphor there of being a dream?
Yeah, he brought that up in the previous paragraphs. That's why he's considering dream. He brought up that the argument is made by bringing to notion the fact that life is like a dream, and or that life is a hallucination. These are the two. That's why if you see the whole chapter is about dream, hallucination, and illusion. So is life like a dream? Yeah, if life is like a dream, why is it that we think dream is an illusion? He's turning around, he's turning the tables on that argument and saying, well, life doesn't have any much of a kind of relationship, or kind of waking life is a different order of reality than dreaming life, and dreaming life has its own kind of meaning as waking life. In other words, it's neither meaningless nor illusory. So to use it as an argument for illusion is an illusory argument.
And this idea of like the dream, which he develops, I guess, in the next paragraph too, as being coming from different sources and such.
Yeah.
Is that something that he is, bringing out for the first time, or have others also, do they have a coherent enough map of the inner worlds that there are other writers who speak about dreams having different sources and attaching some kind of a different importance to them, so to say, based on where they're coming from?
That's a very good question, and I actually don't have a very good answer to that question, because it would mean that we would have to really look at earlier texts, both Western as well as Indian, to see if they have done something like this. My gut feeling is not in this kind of way. Remember, he begins this chapter by talking about, we're quoting from the Upanishads about the worlds of dream and waking and the worlds of dreamless sleep. But their dreams are not analyzed like this. You don't develop a systematic psychology of dreaming. See? And I think this idea of a systematic psychology of dreaming comes to us partly out of Western occult traditions and partly out of modern psychology and his own experience, of course.
Because, if that had to happen, there had to be a somewhat sophisticated the model of the planes and parts of the being as well, correct?
Exactly. Now, what may be the case, of course, and that's why I said one cannot know unless one has delved deeply enough into literature. Yeah. And then, the other real problem with all this is that the Indian tradition, the textual tradition is only, the tip of the iceberg. 9/10 of the Indian tradition is oral tradition, and yogis who experience things and teach it to their own students may very well have developed distinctions of this kind. How much of it actually enters into universal texts, we really don't know. Because this is yogic knowledge from a certain point of view. It's not new in that sense. Freud might be talking about something and Jung might be talking about something. Sri Aurobindo is experiencing something. But these experiences themselves and the ability to analyze dreams may have been part of yogic traditions where people are, talking about these things. I don't know. Again, another text that one might think about, which I'm no expert at, is the whole Tibetan Book of the Dead, as it is so called. It's not really a Book of the Dead, but it is a book of the inner planes, one may say, the inner realms. And to what extent do they develop it? What is the cartography? Whether it is similar to this or not, I don't know. But certainly, there is a certain kind of walking side by side with the modern psychological world that is going on with Sri Aurobindo. There is a negotiation between, worlds of experience, of spiritual experience, worlds of earlier traditions, as well as of modern psychological knowledge, trying to create a systematic picture of the worlds of dream.
Debashish, I think it's worth noting that there was an attempt by Ram Dass and Ralph Metzner and Timothy Leary to map the psychedelic states of consciousness with the Tibetan Book of the Dead, which is interesting when we're talking about this East-West synthesis.
Yeah, that would be interesting to look at, sure. This could be a whole study, and I'm sure there are people, much more, informed about this field than I am in this world of East-West psychology, that you know, maybe Joanna can also throw some light on because of, you know, these particular studies. Yeah, I would say that it's an interesting field that is worth exploring. And I'm sure there are people exploring it.
My understanding, and I don't know the Tibetan Book of the Dead really well, but my understanding is that there is a description there of what happens to the soul after death and how the soul, what the soul goes through to experience rebirth or not, which I think sounds really fascinating. It's been on my list to look at.
Yeah, but I've heard said that, you know, there's been different interpretations of that, and then there are some schools that believe it's really not about death at all. It's really about things like dreaming and trance states, that it's not about where the soul goes between lives, though it does probably pass through similar worlds between lives. But in spiritual states, moving from state of consciousness to state of consciousness, and how those map, and as Margaret was saying, for example, a comparison with psychedelics can be made, or even a comparison with spiritual states of trance, or with dreams, perhaps.
Margaret, would you like to read next?
Yes. But the subconscious is not our soul, dream builder. The subconscious in us is the extreme border of our secret inner existence, where it meets the inconscient. It is a degree of our being in which the inconscient struggles into a half consciousness. The surface physical consciousness also, when it seeks back from the waking level, and retrogresses towards the inconscient, retires into this intermediate subconscious. Or, from another viewpoint, this nether part of us may be described as the antechamber of the inconscient through which its formations rise into our waking or our subliminal being. When we sleep and the surface physical part of us, which is in its first origin here, an output from the inconscient, relapses towards the originating inconscient, it enters into this subconscious element, antechamber or substratum, and there it finds the impressions of its past or persistent habits of mind and experiences. For all have left their mark on our subconscious part, and have there a power of recurrence. In its effect on our waking self, this recurrence often takes the form of a reassertion of old habits, impulses dormant or suppressed, rejected elements of the nature, or it comes up as some other, not so easily recognizable, some peculiar disguised or subtle result of these suppressed or rejected, but not erased impulses or elements. In the dream consciousness, the phenomenon is an apparently fanciful construction, a composite of figures and movements built upon or around the buried impressions with a sense in them that escapes the waking intelligence because it has no clue to the subconscious system of significances. After a time, this subconscious activity appears to sink back into complete inconscience, and we speak of this state as deep dreamless sleep. Thence we emerge again into the dream shallows or return to the waking surface.
So here again, he starts with the subconscious and then opens to the other possibilities, but then delves deeper into the operations of the subconscious. And particularly from this paragraph, we can see that he is mapping. Here there's definitely a clear mapping between what is psychologically called the subconscious with what he is reading into the Sankhya tradition as the citta. So the citta, and I don't know to what extent the citta is addressed in terms of dream, but it is certainly addressed in terms of yoga and in terms of observing the movements of the instincts of the mind, even in something like the Yoga Sutra. The citta is this, he calls it the subconscious layer. It's like a subconscious mentality. And it exists not merely when we sleep, but it exists all the time, even in our waking lives. And it is, as he points out, the layer between the inconscient and the more conscious part, waking part of our consciousness. And this is a distributed consciousness. We may think that the subconscious is something that is receiving impressions, as he says, from the waking world. All that we receive from the waking world sinks into this sensory, reservoir. And out of the sensory reservoir, images are pushed up into our consciousness, even in our waking life, with a certain priority, depending on the kinds of psychological complexes we have at that level. And in yoga, when Sri Aurobindo discusses this, for example, in the seven quartets, he recommends developing a witness consciousness which watches and doesn't get taken over by the kind of charge or pressure that comes out of the images, and because these images come with feelings as well that arise in the surface consciousness, but instead says that they need to be referred to the buddhi, to the higher intelligence. And the higher intelligence itself needs to refer them one further step up to the divine intuition, something above, which casts a light of understanding on them and can accept or not accept. See, something higher has to, read this transcription, as it were, and make sense of it and use it. So that's how we transcend our desire life to some extent, using the transcript of the citta or the subconscious mentality, as he's calling it over here. And it's in those terms that he discusses how it operates in one's dreams.
If there are no questions, shall we plan to stop here and continue next time?
Yeah, sure. I think we've come to the end of our allotted time today.
Thank you, Debashish.
Thank you, Debashish.
Yeah,